Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and in this country, at this moment, and all through its history, we associate hate crimes primarily with white supremacy. We know all too well that communities of color and other marginalized groups are on the receiving end of hate in ways that really affect their lives. But in 2017, according to FBI data, 21% of hate crime offenders were black, although they make up only 13% of the U.S. population. So what does that mean? Should we think of hate crimes any differently when the person committing them is also a person of color or a minority of any kind? And should we take that into account when we're thinking about how to prosecute or frame the narrative around what constitutes a hate crime, or for that matter, what hate is, what racism is? Or should it not matter and hate is hate? WNYC's Matt Katz and Arun Venkatpal are asking those questions. In a new series of reports, they've been investigating an uptick in hate crimes in and around New York City in general, and their news stories focus in on instances where both the victim and the perpetrator of the hate crime are from minority or marginalized groups. They have two separate stories. Matt's focuses on the tense, occasionally violent relationship between the Jewish community and black community in Crown Heights. And Arun looked more broadly at the issue in a story called When People of Color Commit Hate Crimes, and it focuses on a specific crime leveled against a Sikh man. So hi, Matt. Hi, Arun.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
So why did you decide to frame your reporting like this, Arun, to look at instances where people of color are the ones perpetrating a hate crime?
It goes back to an incident which is the center of the story that we aired today. This is going back to 2013. There was a violent assault on the Sikh man, Dr. Prabjot Singh. It got a lot of attention at the time. He was a Columbia University professor, and it was framed as like this awful, understandably awful, incident of Islamophobia, which, although he's Sikh, part of this larger trend of conflating Sikhs and Muslims. At the time, I did notice in some of the coverage, in much of the coverage, it didn't actually identify who the perpetrators were. And to me, that was sort of a conspicuous kind of omission. And when I looked into it, it was clear that there were many young men of color who had attacked him, called him Osama, pulled his beard, beaten him, left him with a broken jaw. And I reached out to him at the time, but it was only now, several years later, that we tried to understand this problem within the larger context of hate crimes that are happening certainly across America and certainly across the five boroughs these days.
So here's a clip from your piece of Prabjot talking about not wanting to press charges at that time because he didn't want more people of color in prison. And at the time, he says the police were arresting a number of black boys who were innocent and blaming them for hate crimes that they didn't commit in other cases.
A young man on a bike stopped me and said, you know, are you that guy, that professor guy? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, fuck you, man.
The young man said he was sorry about the attack, but it also meant he was now a target of police.
He's like, but do you know that if you're a young black man that has a bike, we're being pulled into vans for questioning about whether we attacked you? And he's like, it sucks what happened to you, but it sucks that this happens too.
Yeah. So, Arun, do you think he would have pressed charges if the aggressors had been white and otherwise the same things had been done to him?
No, he explicitly said no. He was not simply distinguishing because in this case the perpetrators or the alleged perpetrators were non-white. He has been assaulted on a number of occasions. This is something you hear from many Sikh men, is that they are harassed or assaulted very frequently, especially in the wake of 9/11. And some of those incidents involved white people. He thinks in general, I think this sort of thrusts into his mind the fact that there is an over sort of an overuse of the criminal justice system, and that the results are highly punitive, and that they don't produce results. And he is very connected to his community uptown, and he did not want to see that happen to members of his community.
So rather than prosecution, he preferred to try to pursue something that he calls restorative justice?
The thing is, when this happened to him, he didn't actually know or have an option to his mind. He sort of sat in this kind of limbo state. He simply disconnected from the entire incident. He didn't know what had happened to the one person who was charged in the wake of it. I had to tell him. I was like, oh, it was the Manhattan DA. I checked in with them a couple weeks ago, and they said that person ended up serving a year in jail. I didn't get much more than that. Christian Morales, a young Latino man. For him, he did not want to be in the position of having to advocate for a jail sentence or prison term for this person or these people, nor did he know how to sort of disengage from it. Now, in recent times, seeing all this, I think he is increasingly thinking that restorative justice options are one of the best sort of tools we have to deal with this larger problem.
So let's actually bring in another guest for just a minute on this. Deputy Commissioner of the New York City Commission on Human Rights, Marissa Jackson, actually got in touch with us today after hearing your story, Arun.
Great.
To talk a little bit about the restorative justice option that does actually exist for some cases in New York City. Deputy Commissioner, thank you for chiming in. Hello.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
What were you thinking when you heard Arun's story?
Well, I was really thinking that, you know, in New York, people have a lot of restorative justice options through the Commission on Human Rights. The commission was actually founded as a way to sort of heal the city after the Harlem race riots in the 1940s. And so restorative justice is a lens that we sort of have applied in a very mainstreamed way throughout the agency in both our enforcement and our education and bias response work.
So what would have happened, theoretically, if all parties had been aware after this attack on Probejot back in 2013 of this option and had chosen to pursue it?
Well, so, of course, you know, there are incidents, and it sounds like this is one of the incidents where it would have been a criminal matter, and we're a civil law enforcement agency. But if they had still wanted to also file with the commission, and we had sort of done an investigation, one of the options we would have likely, you know, offered was, you know, come in and learn about the human rights law, you know, get some training, also, you know, perhaps some community service. And we find that that's a very effective method to not only sort of explain to the perpetrator, like, that the pain is real that they've caused, but, like, why? And, you know, what would be a better option for, you know, communities affected to sort of build solidarity going forward and to sort of treat each other mm-hmm. better under
so,
the law?
So you think restorative justice is a particularly useful tool when it comes to hate crimes?
I think, there are hate crimes, and then there are incidents that may not rise to the level of a crime, but that are still very painful, that are still very harmful and deleterious to community relations. And so I think that restorative justice is very, very effective in all of those scenarios. Many people who are involved in these bias incidents are actually quite young and really haven't gotten the kind of civic education that they needed. And we, as the commission, are able to provide that and give people, you know, knowledge and awareness of what the law requires of folks and what the law provides folks.
So Marissa Jackson, Deputy Commissioner at the New York City Commission on Human Rights, thank you so much for calling in and adding your voice to this.
Thanks for having us.
And now we turn to WNYC's Matt Katz. As listeners, if you're just joining us, we're listening to excerpts from stories by Matt Katz and Arun Venugopal, both on the issue of hate crimes in New York City. They've been investigating the recent rise, and today on the particular question of people of color or people in other minority groups who commit hate crimes. Matt, your story, I see, is about hate crimes committed against members of the Hasidic community in Crown Heights. How does it fit into this larger umbrella of hate crimes committed by members of minority groups?
Right. That's what I was trying to figure out. I mean, most of the hate crimes in New York target Jews more than any other group. But most are swastikas. Most are not violent, except in parts of Brooklyn like Crown Heights. And in the last year, attacks against Jews on the streets of Crown Heights have really jumped. It went from two in 2017. These are Jewish victims of assaults and robberies in Crown Heights, 2 in 2017 to 10 in 2018. And the Orthodox community there is quite concerned about this. There's reports of people like jogging and walking quickly home from synagogue during Shabbos because they don't want to be out alone. You have just Jewish men getting jumped. I was in Crown Heights a couple weeks ago, and elsewhere in the neighborhood while I was there, a man kicked a stroller carrying two Jewish children. So it's unclear. The NYPD doesn't break down who the perpetrators are and what their ethnicities are, but surveillance video and reports from the victims indicate that several of these, many of them perhaps, many of the perpetrators are black boys and black young men. So I went to Crown Heights to try to figure out why, and it does seem like a lot of it might not be the sort of strain of anti-Semitism that we see nationally that's rising, but rather concerns more locally to the community, like gentrification, like a housing crisis, like affordability, and Jews who present Jewish with black hats and beards are being victimized because they're blamed for it. They're blamed as being the landlords who are evicting black families or driving black owners out of the community.
And so here's a clip from your piece of Pastor Gil Monrose, a black leader in the neighborhood. He's director of the faith-based initiatives for the Brooklyn Borough President, and he's describing the tensions between the communities, saying in this clip that it has largely to do with housing.
The average person is going to say, yeah, those Jews, you know, they're coming and they're taking up our land and another Jew man bought the building. That's the kind of talk that you're hearing, yes. If people believe that their livelihood is being threatened, if people believe that they're being forced out or kicked out, whether it's true or not, sometimes they're going to respond in a way that is violent.
And you say in the reporting that there were lots of incidents where black residents felt that they had been pushed out or had relatives pushed out of housing by pushy landlords, and they were some people who went violent. Those few were willing to take it out on sort of random Orthodox-looking Jews on the street. But you also talked to Rabbi Yaakov Berman, a Chabad activist who pushed back on that idea and said Jews feel the effect of gentrification too.
The other hand, you have a unique problem that Crown Heights is dealing with is that you have a tremendous poverty and gentrification, and there is a false story being peddled that somehow the Jews are treated differently than the broader community, that the Jews are not suffering as a result of gentrification. And that's a lie.
Yeah. Yeah, Bierman said that hundreds of Orthodox Jews have had to move out of Crown Heights because they can't afford it. And Monrose, the pastor we heard from before, he's been working with a friend of his, Evan Bernstein, who's the head of the ADL for New York and New Jersey. They actually just got back from Poland, where they visited Nazi concentration camps, and they are planning other trips with pastors from African-American pastors, Caribbean-American pastors from Crown Heights to go over to Poland. They also want to bring Jewish leaders down to the African-American Museum in Washington. There is, unlike, you know, the so-called Crown Heights riots that are a backdrop to all of this, there is, unlike then, a lot of efforts among black leaders and Jewish leaders in Crown Heights working together. They have each other's cell phone numbers. They meet. They don't always agree on how to deal with this, but they're talking about it, and they're working, trying to develop programs for children to lead to some sort of cultural understanding, if that might be a way to stem this new violence.
We're talking with WNYC's Matt Katz and Arun Venugopal, who are both reporting on hate crimes in and around New York City up in the last few years, and also looking at solutions and looking at this from all kinds of angles, including the main one for their most recent pieces having to do with when people of color or members of other minority groups commit the crimes and they're not coming from a place of white supremacy. Arun, how do you think you and Matt have been working together on stuff like this for years now. How do you think these two latest pieces relate to each other?
They're definitely, you know, we both have been, especially in the wake of the election, focused on similar themes of white supremacy, anti-immigrant hysteria, xenophobia, and hate crimes of a certain kind. And I think that when you live in a city as diverse as this, it doesn't take long before you realize it doesn't play out in that very sort of stereotypical young, white, angry man kind of a way, that there are a lot of different people who are hurting different kinds of people. And so it gets messy. And it also forces the issue of, you know, how are we going to deal with that as a society? I mean, we have, like, right now with these stories that we've both done, I think you have two trends that appear to be in conflict. One is the trend, the realization as a society that we have an extraordinary number of people in prison, in jails, and that it's really expensive, it's highly racialized, and it is sadistic. And it doesn't deliver results for us as a society. The other trend is that bias crimes have to be dealt with seriously. Especially as we're grappling with this this surge in hate. So the idea being, put them away. As a society, that's how we deliver a message. And these trends are in conflict with each other. How do we deal with that when not everybody is that young, angry white man, even if it is? Is that the solution, to put that person behind bars? It's messy.
Matt, how do you see the two pieces relating to each other?
I mean, they're so related because it's so complicated. I mean, it's not just simple that one ethnic group has no contact with another ethnic group and they therefore, like, fight on the streets. I mean, I called one black community member, and then I got a text from a Jewish leader a few minutes later. He said, "I heard you just talk to my trainer," because this community leader happened to be his trainer and helps him work out twice a week. I heard talk of old men, old Jewish men and old black men who have lived next door to each other in Crown Heights for 40 years, and they talk about jazz when they run into each other on the weekends. And yet at the same time, I went to a school in PS 289, a mostly black student, where there's a mostly black student body. And next door to the school is the Jewish Children's Museum, the Brooklyn Jewish Children's Museum. And almost they asked how many kids have been to the museum. Almost none of the kids have been there. So you have this, like, separation that is not the rule, but it is extremely evident. And then you have some hate, but that is not, like, the rule either. It just manifests itself in these moments on the street. And then you have the national backdrop, and you have people on each side believing that the other side is stoking anti-Semitism. I heard from Orthodox Jews in the streets of Brooklyn both that it was Trump's fault and that it was Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's fault that there's been new anti-Semitism in Crown Heights. So this is, as Arun said, quite messy. We just hope to try to take a snapshot of it. This is not a full sociological study to understand what is driving hate right now in New York City. We're just hoping to tell some stories that give a little bit of a window to understand what is going on.
And Arun, you are focused on solutions in addition to just painting the picture, right?
Yeah, I think that for me, this was a window into the world of restorative justice. I understand very little of it. It is a very complicated field. It is growing, though. I think it really is a response to what are seen as the failures and the excesses of the criminal justice, and it's seen as a way of recapturing humanity in ways that play out in communities like Crown Heights and in the kind of reporting Matt has done, and in other communities across the city. Is like, how do we go forward?
Matt, same question. Solutions.
Yeah, there are a number of solutions being talked about. And one is bringing the leaders of each community to, bring Jewish leaders to the Weeksville Heritage Center, which is a place in Crown Heights that examines and commemorates the freed slaves who settled in the area 100 or so years ago. And then bringing black leaders to Poland to visit the concentration camps. So each side has a sense of the injustices in the respective backgrounds. There's also an effort by a black leader and a Jewish leader to visit schools, both public schools and yeshivas, to ask what's going on. They call it a listening tour. Eli Cohn is a Jewish leader, and his friend is Jeffrey Davis, whose brother was Councilman James Davis, who was shot and killed in City Hall several years ago. Jeffrey Davis and Eli Cohn are going to these schools, Jewish schools and public schools, say, why do you think people are attacking each other in the street? What's going on? What can we do about it? And that's one effort. And then there's some information that they're getting that's interesting. There was one black student who raised their hand and said, why are there tents on the streets and the sidewalks of Crown Heights? We can't always walk through them when outside the synagogues. And there are these big tents that are sometimes set up in the public passageways when there's overflow crowds at Chabad for prayers during holidays. And maybe that's one thing that bothers some residents who aren't Jews. And this might be good for the Jewish community to know and be sensitive to. So there's certainly efforts. It all revolves around dialogue. That's what it all seems to come back to. If we're talking, then we're not punching each other on the street.
WNYC's Matt Katz and Arun Venugopal continue to look at all kinds of hate crimes in and around New York City. In their reporting, you can hear their latest pieces on our website if you missed them on the radio at WNYC.org. Thank you both.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.